Hello, everyone, and welcome to Oncology Decoded, where cancer science meets clarity. I'm your host, Manoj Bhupathi, and with me is Ben Garmazy. Thank you so much for joining us today. Ben, I'm going to turn it off to you. Today is a Friday, and we're recording, but here we go.
Yeah, classic Friday afternoons with Dr. Bhupathi at Oncology Decoded. One of the best parts of the week.
You wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in and listening. We have some interesting topics. We're going to talk about RCC, but before we do, there was an FDA approval announcement. Enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab was recently approved in the cisplatin ineligible patient population. We'll break that down on another podcast when we have a bit more time, but wanted to get that out there. That's very interesting. And we just talked about our ESMO updates where that rose to the top. And now not only is an ESMO update, it's going to be available to you in clinic starting today. So very exciting to hear from and look forward to digging into that a little bit more.
Yeah, what an exciting option for our patients altogether. And we just talked about it 2 weeks ago, as you're saying. So this is fantastic. To kind of shift gears, we're going to talk about oligometastatic kidney cancer, and we'll talk about IKCS. So Ben and I were both at IKCS just last weekend. It was a fantastic conference here in Denver, Colorado. So we got great clinicians from all over, along with researchers, patients, and advocates to attend the conference here in Colorado. And fantastic conference. What'd you think, Ben?
Yeah, so IKCS is the kidney cancer conference that happens every year. There's one in America, one outside the US, and it's always a good way for us to get together. It's kind of a nice mix of basic science research, translational research, and clinical research. You know, we're not going to dig into all of that today because that's outside the scope of what we try to do on this podcast, but it was a really good conference, and I think a couple of nice discussions were crystallized around it. One of them is in oligometastatic kidney cancer. So I think we're gonna focus on that in this podcast because I think it's very clinically relevant to all those of you listening. But how do we actually treat these patients? There's a couple of different goals in mind, and I'm really excited. And I'll say, you know, the best thing about IKCS outside the data was the fact that right outside the hotel was a hot chicken spot. Nashville had already moved to Denver before I got there, so I actually did get some Friday after I landed, just to see. The local fair in Denver, Colorado. You know, had to buy everything that Colorado had to offer.
Did it compare to Nashville?
I can't say that it did. But anyways, let's dive in. I want to jump in and start because I think this is a topic that has more questions than answers, right? And I think you'll agree with that. And maybe we're going to disagree. But when I think about oligometastatic treatment in any solid tumor, we need to discuss what does that mean? There's no real definition. We talk about it a lot more in prostate cancer. We don't talk about it as much in kidney cancer, though there are new emerging data sets that are trying to better define this. So Manoj, can you walk us through what you think an oligometastatic kidney cancer patient looks like?
Yeah. So, you know, so to kind of level set, right? Oligometastatic generally refers to disease which is limited to number of metastases. Generally speaking, the consensus is less than or equal to 5 sites. Now, it can be in many different ways. It can be thought in different ways, right? So one of them is synchronous, which means that it was developed at the time of diagnosis. Another one is metachronous, meaning that it was developing after the primary treatment. Then you also have oligoprogressive disease, meaning that you have patients that are starting on systemic therapy and then now starting to have certain areas where the cancer is actually progressing. So those are the three big categories that I look at or think about when I think about oligometastatic prostate cancer. Keep thinking prostate because we talk about prostate cancer in this a lot more than we do in kidney cancer. But the definitions are very similar in both prostate cancer and in kidney cancer in my mind.
Yeah, I mostly agree with you. And I think the Freudian slip is perfect there because when I think about a kidney cancer patient, if they have 4 metastases, I get nervous treating them as an oligometastatic. I don't have a good reason for that.
What's the reason?
I don't know. It's just, I feel like our treatments in prostate cancer, especially in MHSPC, are so good, right? So you're going to radiate there. You know that you're going to debulk with your hormone therapies, right? And your ARPIs or whatever they may be. In kidney cancer, while our response rates are quite high, they're not quite as high in prostate. And when I look at the data sets, and I fortunately had to look at the data sets to present at IKCS on this topic, almost all patients on these studies had 2 or less. So, and most had 1. So these are something that we need to keep in mind when we think about what is the data that supports it. Now, I would never ever think it's wrong to treat a patient with 4 or 5 metastases as an oligometastatic kidney cancer patient, but they are on a different spectrum than the data that we have that provides us. So to me, I'm thinking 3 generally in clinic, but is there a patient with 4 metastases that I would treat as oligometastatic? Probably. When I also think about kidney cancer, I do think a little bit more about the sites of disease. I'm thinking if they have disease in, say, the lungs and the bones, or 2 organs that aren't lymph nodes, I may not be treating that patient as an oligometastatic kidney cancer patient. I don't know why. But again, how do you feel about it? Say they got bone metastases and liver metastases, or bone and lung, or 2 spots. Do you feel differently?
No, I feel somewhat similar. Where I do differ is a number of spots, though. I think it really comes to the biology of it, right? So generally, you think about oligometastatic disease, and at least the way I think about it in kidney cancer, are those are patients who have more of a favorable biology, as opposed to the ones that have more of a higher risk biology, right? So if you think about the sarcomatoid, rhabdoid features, grade 4, large lesion, large liver met, kidney mass, and a number of other spots, they're not patients that I would think about as more oligometastatic. They're more true metastatic disease. Let's start them on systemic therapy, see how they respond, and then maybe you can consolidate with like a surgery or something else down the line. But the true oligometastatic patient for kidney cancer, in my mind, are those that have more of an indolent course, favorable risk, lower grade, lower size of tumors that we're seeing. That's generally how I'm looking at it, more than the true number of spots. The accepted definition, which is what I was referring to earlier, is like less than 5 across tumor types, across trials. Generally speaking, that is really what I've come to terms.
Yeah, no, I think those are fair points. And I think we should, again, let's go back to de novo versus recurrent. Let's start in de novo, because I do think the goals in de novo and recurrent are a little bit different. And the way I view these patients is definitely different. So let's say a patient comes into clinic de novo, metastatic clear cell disease, right? Maybe they have a grade 3, you know, they're not quite sarcomatoid, but they're not a grade 1 or 2 on the path. And they have a 9 centimeter kidney mass or a 10 centimeter kidney mass. And they have, say, 3 lung metastases. How are you going to treat that patient?
Yeah, I'm probably going to start them on systemic therapy first, allow for some cytoreduction, and then I'll think about either nephrectomy with SBRT to the lung metastasis. But that's how I would think about it. I would probably allow at least 3 to 6 months on treatment, then make that decision.
For me, I'm thinking, you know, when we have patients where we think about a neoadjuvant approach, right? Generally, okay, our urologists are mandating who's going to get the neoadjuvant therapy, right? Because they feel like the surgery is too difficult. So you're going to start them on some kind of doublet treatment and hope to debulk that tumor so they can go to surgery. In an oligometastatic approach, it's almost the same thing, right? Let's not go in and do a nephrectomy. Let's start treatment. I generally think about 6 months to 12 months, but generally around 6. Let's do that. Let's see what happens. And then let's remove the primary mass if we've had a nice response. And then consider if we want to do anything else to the oligometastatic sites, whether it be a metastatectomy or SBOT. So I completely agree with you on that. We might quibble on the timing, but I think it's going to be patient dependent, right? There may be some patients with such a good response in 3 months, you're removing that kidney. And other patients, you're kind of heading, okay, it's a partial PR, and we're going to see what happens on the next scan before we have to hold therapy for, you know, healing from a nephrectomy. So I agree with all of that. And I think that patient population is a different population than, say, the recurrent metastatic patient in an oligometastatic setting. Do we have anything more to say on the de novo patients before we move forward?
No, I don't think so. I think we just generally have to think about where that site of metastasis is, right? So if it's a patient that has 6 liver metastasis, I don't know that I would go the approach of oligometastatic just based on the biology. So yeah. I think that's the only caveat that I would throw in there, but otherwise, no. Now, when we come about the metachronous, again, the metachronous of those are the patients that initially had some sort of surgery up front, whether it be a partial or complete nephrectomy, and then now developing metastasis after some period of time. Now, that time period is always a little bit tricky, and it's always going to be, well, did they get adjuvant? Did they not get adjuvant? And how are you going to classify that risk? So we're going to assume that none of that exists. And it's really, they had their surgery. And then now here we are a few years later, and they've developed oligometastatic. For my definition, I would say less than 5, because I'm thinking more indolent. For Ben's definition, less than 4. So we'll see how would you approach it?
Yeah. So, I mean, let's say, you know, 2 lung metastases, right? That's the perfect patient to have, I think, these debates over. It's okay. Do we start systemic therapy, or do we just treat the isolated lesions? And I think now we have a lot of data sets to support treating the isolated lesions. Now, however, I think we need to have 2 goals in mind. This is the easiest way to frame it. Is our goal of a patient with a recurrent oligometastatic disease to increase the cure rate or to go for treatment-free survival? Both are reasonable goals, and it's depending on the patient in front of us. If we're increasing the cure rate, I think some of those patients may prefer systemic therapy and, say, radiation or surgery, just like the paradigm we do in prostate cancer. In other patients that, you know, maybe they're older and we just want to keep them away from the side effects of therapy, SBRT alone or surgery alone may be beneficial. I think that's the way to think about it, because we have the best data sets we have are to delay systemic therapy. So MD Anderson's phase 2 data set, Chad Tang, excellent, excellent data set showing that you can have nearly a 2-year treatment-free survival before you have to start therapy by doing radiation alone to these lesions. However, they require recurrent radiation, almost like a whack-a-mole strategy, to continue to keep those patients off therapy. It can be effective in a certain patient population, but you may also miss a window and a patient could develop metastatic disease in a place that's harder to treat. That was shown in other data sets where some patients that weren't able to start therapy because they died. So if we're going to go a radiation alone or a surgery alone strategy, I do think it's very critical that we highly select those patients. Now, some of us might say, why not do radiation and add in immune therapy? And that's kind of where I like to sit, though we don't have great data. We have phase 2 data sets to suggest that that's reasonable. They've never been compared appropriately to anything else. And what we don't know is whether or not we should give an immunotherapy doublet or just PD-1 alone. So I don't know. You gave me a nod, you shook your head yes when I said add in the immunotherapy. So tell me, what are you doing with these patients, Manoj? What are you doing?
That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm usually thinking about giving them some sort of local therapy, right? So, or local regional therapy, whether it be surgery or radiation, usually radiation, because surgery, just the complexity as well as the recovery and everything else, radiation is just far easier. So generally thinking radiotherapy and then adding in immunotherapy afterwards, right? So when you look at the KEYNOTE trial that looked at adjuvant pembrolizumab, it did allow for patients who had M1 disease, but that was treated M1. So can you really extrapolate from that group of patients and say, maybe, you know, could you say that they were treated and now they could have been potentially eligible? But I think that's a slightly different population. But again, if you give them immunotherapy, would they actually prevent or would they have a benefit from PFS is really what my thought would be.
And you're going radiation first and then say a year of immune therapy?
Potentially. I think it depends on how long we are away, how many spots are we looking at, right? And then what type of biology are we looking at? Because usually these are patients that end up getting a biopsy to prove that it's kidney cancer and not something else. And if it shows that it's got more aggressive features, then, you know, probably. But if it shows that it's, you know, low grade, like grade 1 RCC, and they are 5 years out from their original diagnosis and they have 1 lung spot, I don't know that committing them to a year of immunotherapy afterwards is something that I would do. But if they're a year out from the original surgery, you have a biopsy and it's like grade 3 RCC and they have 2 lung nodules, I'd probably radiate both of them and talked about possibly giving them immunotherapy. So I think there's 2 different patients that we can think about in terms of who would you think about immunotherapy and who would you not think about immunotherapy.
I completely agree. Number of years from the time of the nephrectomy to the recurrence is critical when thinking who we can give radiation alone to. So I completely agree with that. Basically everything you said. What I struggle with is, should I be giving ipi/nivo for like 4 cycles and then radiating them and then continuing them on nivo to finish out a year or 2, or should I just be doing adjuvant pembro or something like that? Most of the time, And I'll be honest, I don't know the right answer. Most of the time, I'm just doing a year of Pembro after the radiation. And because I'm worried about the toxicity of the ipilimumab may not be justified if we're going to radiate those lesions. We know that the adjuvant ipi-nivo did not pan out, though that was only 6 months of therapy. And obviously, that is a completely different setting, right? That maybe we should or should not be cross-applying. But if we don't have data, we have to make choices. And generally, I'm leaning on single agent. Now, if they had a sarcomatoid biology or something like that, I probably would lean on adding in the CTLA-4. But I think those are more rare cases in this situation. And I've treated a couple of these patients alone in the last few months. So they do come up. This is something that's real and that we actually see in clinic. And that's what I'm doing for now.
So Ben, let me ask you a question. You know, we're talking about immunotherapy, and you know, we don't really talk about TKIs in this kind of scenario.
Yeah.
Would you ever consider a TKI outside of the true contraindication for immunotherapy? Is there a situation where you would say, well, I may give this patient cabo, or I may give this patient, I'm going to go really old, Sutent, right? Like, I don't think anybody really uses Sutent. I don't know that I've written for Sutent in the last like 5 years, but I'm just asking, like, is there any other TKI that would say, tell you, or you would think about saying, well, this is a situation where I would think about using this?
In the oligometastatic setting?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
So your go-to would be immunotherapy more than TKI.
If I'm cytoreducing with special laser beams of radiation, then I don't know what I need the VEGF inhibitor for. Now, I completely think that, let's say we gave radiation and then we started them on an IO TKI regimen instead of an IO regimen. I imagine you would improve, you know, DFS or whatever we want to call the endpoint here, because the TKI is going to be like, in the adjuvant studies, some of them did show no OS, but did show that, you know, by the amount of time you were on therapy, increased the amount of time before you recurred. That was the Sutent, the S-TRAC study. But then you have the side effects of the TKI. I don't think we've proven that there would be any kind of OS benefit here. So to me, if I'm going to cytoreduce with radiation, then I'm not going to layer in a TKI, just like I wouldn't layer in docetaxel in the oligometastatic prostate cancer in this situation. But again, I don't know that it would be crazy to start somebody on an IO TKI regimen and then kind of treat with radiation after 3 months or so of therapy if they didn't med out. I think that would be another paradigm that you could consider.
Interesting. Yeah, I can't disagree with anything you said. I think completely the same thing. It's just more of a thought, right? Because it's an easy tool. It's you know, you can dose it, you can stop it, you can do whatever from a convenience standpoint, as opposed to infusions and such. But I shift gears to oligoprogressive kidney cancer, right? So in the spectrum of oligometastatic, if you have patients that had synchronous metastatic disease, and then you started them on systemic therapy, and now they have oligoprogressive kidney cancer, how do you think about it?
Yeah, I think about it a little bit different depending on the way they're oligoprogressing. Say they're on, they got immunotherapy doublet up front, right? And now they're on the Nevo phase, and they've been on the Nevo phase for 9 months or so, not right away. And we have one spot that's grown a centimeter, but everything else is under control and hasn't grown at all. I'll probably radiate that spot and continue on the nivolumab. I think the reason for that is perhaps that one microenvironment has become immune resistant, whatever pathway has led it to resistance and the heterogeneity of the tumor evolution. And now we're going to keep that patient on single agent nivolumab and not increase their toxicity burden. I think that's a great use case. Let's say they're on an IOTKI and they have oligoprogression. Well, I'm going to make really darn sure that I think it's just that one site, because otherwise I have a low threshold to just try to switch the TKI. But I have done it in the IOTKI setting as well. I do it a lot more, I feel like, in the ipi-nivo setting, but I wonder what you're doing.
Before I go to what I'm doing, I'm curious, is there a threshold on how many spots, you know, that would bother, that would make you switch therapy as opposed to continuing on the same and then radiate? You know, earlier you were saying 4, I said 5. Here, how do you think about it?
I'm going to say 1 or 2 spots. Because otherwise, we are really having systemic escape of that disease. That's my concern.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to throw a little caveat. I think I would go up to 3, and I think it depends on how long they were on that systemic therapy and what their INDC score is. So for me, if someone is truly favorable risk, INDC risk criteria, and they've been on, let's say, Maxi, Pemlan, Cabo-Nivo, whatever you want to say, whatever you want to give them as first line, and they've made it a year, year and a half, and then now we're still slowly starting to see a few lung nodules that are increasing in size or a period of 3 to 6 months, I wouldn't necessarily consider that as treatment failure. I think it's just slow progressive disease for that specific criteria. My threshold would be about 3, I think. And that's what I've done. And I just radiate those 3, and then I would continue on the same systemic therapy. Now, certainly if someone has more intermediate or poorer risk disease, completely agree with you. I think my threshold would be sneakier disease, don't want to take a chance, would rather just switch therapy and try to be more aggressive. And if they respond and everywhere except that one other site, then I would radiate that site.
There you go. I mean, I think we need a poll now. We need to figure out how many sites do you agree with one of us or none of us, right? Because I can't argue with you that you're right or wrong. I don't know why. I guess I'm a nervous guy when it comes to oligometastatic RCC compared to you. Because in prostate cancer, I'm the opposite. It's interesting, you know, it's all past experience and you know, our availability heuristic of what patients we've seen in clinic over the last 6 months. But I think, you know, we're both directionally in the same corner here, right? And we're quibbling over the margin. So I think that's good. And, you know, thinking more about where do we go from here, right? So how do we improve upon outcomes? I mean, is there any thoughts you have about how do we better define this? How do we better standardize this approach for patients? Is there anything, you know, us out there in the community can be doing to better, you know, figure out how to treat these patients?
Really, I think it comes down to multi-D clinics, right? Like multi-tumor approach or disciplinary approach from radiation, surgery, as well as medical oncology to figure out, you know, which spots are truly progressing or and how many that is. I mean, certainly we need our radiology colleagues to help us figure that out. You know, if you're asking me, how would I design a trial for this to figure out, is this something that we would do? I think that's a little bit more challenging for me. I think these patients, they're very subjective here, right? Because if you're, you know, are you going to call 8 millimeters to 1 centimeter progression versus the 5 millimeters to 6 millimeters or so, like, what are you going to define and how are you going to define that change? I think there's a lot more nuances, which is what makes this area so much more challenging.
Yeah, I think these are fair points. And then any nuances in non-clear cell, for me, when I think about it, you know, I'm less likely to love the idea of single agent immune therapy, right? In a papillary or a chromophobe or a translocation-based tumor. I'm still going to do oligometastatic-based approach with surgery or radiation, but I get a little bit nervous. And sometimes maybe I won't layer in any of the systemic therapy and instead be thinking more about, you know, time off treatment instead of the other goals, but maybe you're treating them a little bit differently.
So, you know, the non-clear cell always make me a lot more nervous than clear cell.
Yeah.
And so clear cell, I think I'm far more comfortable in my approaches that I've been mentioning so far. But in non-clear, just kind of given the nature of the disease and depending on what type of non-clear cell we're talking about, whether it be papillary, chromophobe, translocation, whichever one, and those cancers or subtypes just make me far more nervous. While I do think about the localized approaches, I'm much more cognizant and much more reserved as to which patients am I really thinking about that for versus in clear cell RCC. I think I feel that I'm probably more liberal in when I do that.
Hmm. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I don't think none of these studies have really approached that. To me, the reason I shift on less, our therapies don't work quite as well, so I'm less likely to give them. I mean, that's just my whole logic behind it. But none of these studies have really addressed that. And every biology is different in non-clear cell. So none of us have a ton of those patients in our clinic with oligometastatic disease.
Let me ask you this question. I actually saw this patient of this yesterday, and I'm going to get your opinion as a second opinion since we're talking about oligometastatic, right? But I saw a patient yesterday who had kidney cancer, right-sided, 25 years ago, complete nephrectomy. Now, in 10 years ago, she developed a left-sided kidney cancer at an ablation. Here we are, 25, so 10 years later from the second kidney cancer, 25 years later from the original kidney cancer on the right side, now developed a paraspinal mass from T3 to T4, about 5 centimeters long or big. How would you approach it?
Wow. First of all, I'd test for VHO and think about belzutifan in that patient. But I would probably do surgery and then radiate after surgery and probably continue to watch. You're talking about like 20 years, 10 years, 5 years?
No, it's 25 years and 10 years.
25 and 10, that's what I would do. I wouldn't do any systemic therapy unless I would probably just surgically remove it. I would change my scan intervals. You probably at that point we're scanning every year. I'd probably go back to every 3 months for a year or so and make sure nothing else developed. But that's, I think, how I would handle it. What'd you do?
That's exactly what I did. I sent her to go see neurosurgery and then I told her maybe radiation, but maybe nothing afterwards. And then just watch because the indolence of the disease, right? So that's where I was wanting to talk about this case because I know we had some difference in opinion in terms of how would we look about this. But I think when I think about oligometastatic, this is the, I guess, one extreme of it versus the other extreme of it is patients that are actually on systemic therapy and then having like 4 sites of disease that are progressing. That's the other part of
it. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a good case. Hopefully she does well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all I have for oligometastatic kidney cancer. I keep saying prostate, but it's kidney. Any other thoughts, Ben?
No other thoughts. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And if you're listening to this right after Thanksgiving, but you know, I think overall it's an exciting time in GU cancer. We're going to have a lot more for you coming into 2026 and hopefully some surprises as well. So stay tuned. Catch us on X at Oncology Decoded and also on our email as well at Gmail, which is, what is it, Manoj? Tell us.
Podcast at oncologydecoded.com.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all.